first poem I read is about seaside in winter and the tented people that are referred to are the travellers who love the colour red and songs of Elvis Presley and John Wayne films. It's called Desertion. The summer crowds have departed, all the parasol tricycles, the golfers on the hill, the old lady who sings Knees Up Mother Brown, unveiling varicose veins for Americans in the Warwick Hotel. The couple walking at Salt Hill married quietly out of season. He was a civil servant, she owned half a house. Disharmony entered the bedroom at night, broken glass shone on the tarmac outside, swings were padlocked in the playgrounds. United by day, they bypassed the distasteful, the fields of tented people, predominance of pink among clothes on the bushes, the dry, unhealthy, fair hair of the children, large rats stirring in the reeds, hacking the foam of a discarded armchair. It is a cloudy Sunday. They are doing the promenade. No swimmers, nothing to disturb faint sunlight on the water, only a wooden diving raft, its roped matting the colour of a bishop's beret. Further out to sea, framed by rungs of the raft ladder, a tug is also leaving. As kids, we lived near the cemetery, and funerals in small Irish town were a social occasion, not like in the city where maybe it's half an hour for half a dozen people between appointments. And there may have been two funerals on a good or bad day. And as kids, we joined the mourners, and being children, you were pushed along to the front of the crowd, and you know, you were by the graveside. So the cemetery was divided into two sections. The Catholic section, the people just died. But in the Protestant section, was much nicer. They entered eternal rest, and they were called home, or they sleepeth there. Now, just in the second part, there's a reference to the arrival of Ronald Reagan to receive an honorary degree from the National University of Ireland at Galway. And weeks before he came to Ireland, the security men, secret service men, they came wearing white coats, and they were readily recognisable, checking any vantage points, looking in manholes, climbing on hospital roofs, that kind of thing. So it's just called In the Free World. And I suppose the free world is everywhere America holds sway. No, we are not finally called home. When we get out of this particular neck of the woods, there is nothing on the other side. Not the parents of Monsignor de Brun, the ex-members of the Artain Boys Band, or a single representative from Taiwan. Each year, we become less. We anticipate the debts to come of those we truly love. Will they be relayed by telephone or personally face to face, inadvertently from a stranger's mouth, once or twice perhaps in letters? For the umpteenth time, a voice on the television is saying, here he is, the most powerful man in the Western world. And the omnipresent attaché case. Overhead, the helicopters are whirring. The manholes have all been checked. I am losing contact with even the innermost things. The day we were released early from Dunalley Infant School, one of the teachers had gone to the well. We walked home under trees. The light played marvellous tricks along the clayey path. The sun shone through between the moving leaves, etc., catching the puddles underneath. Oh, to be in Dunaree with the sweetheart I once knew. I held my sister's small hand, not wanting to reach the main road. Now, the next group of poems, short poems, were written in London the summer before last, a time of official cruelty, when every public vehicle that had wheels seemed destined to crash. And when the Prime Minister declared, why is this so? We wonder, is it because people are getting out more? If with increased prosperity, people are getting out about more. So these poems then are set in London. First one is meeting an old woman on Vauxhall Bridge, pensioner. On Vauxhall Bridge Road, she stood in a trance, her handbag open, the money showing. She'd been to the post office. He was a saucy chap, a foreigner, a very saucy chap. Was I in the war? She had a terrible war. Another military ambulance went flashing by, and a minibus of traffic wardens headed for Coston Street, done for the evening. Surrey side. This morning, at Quinlan Terry's Toy Town Riverside, I saw two police frogmen standing in their wetsuits, being hosed and disinfected, lest they catch Vial's disease while diving for suicides. The usual painting group was in session, doing clear skies over Richmond Bridge, and an early angler with a tin full of maggots, bubbling like Rice Krispies. Lost leader. Her manic gleam may or may not be a clinical feature of hormone replacement therapy. Consider the Greek girl in the Costa Coffee unit at Waterloo Station. So many of her customers have nervous twitches. She thinks it must be genetic, peculiar to the place, like the barefooted semi-survivor in an ancient guide's uniform, two schoolgirl cricket pads tied to her flaking shins. Unmarried Miss Roberts, down to her last possession, a signed copy of Mrs. Tim Carries On, leaves from the diary of an officer's wife in the year 1940. Now, the most frightening thing about the poem I'll try now is that it needs no embellishment. It's taken from life. It's set in a Catholic marriage advisory centre in a pre-marriage course. If you want to get married in a Catholic church in the south of Ireland, which is 90% of the people, you have to undergo one of these. Then you get a certificate and you go forth. It's called, which is a truly drastic prospect, Love is for Life. The latest bulletin on love declares it to be breathtakingly beautiful. On the cover, two white doves in a blue sky are backgrounded against a scene from the Canadian woodlands. Fergus reads from the pamphlet at the Catholic Marriage Advisory Centre. It's you two against the world, he tells the engaged couples. Fergus is happily married for 22 years, expert at bridging loans, blessed with 7 children. The course tutor, his sister Dervla, carries in thermometers and charts to illustrate the Billings method. When Dervla mentions the word mucus in an entirely sexual context, the spiritual advisor, Father O'Carroll, quietly leaves the room. On a blackboard behind Dervla, Fergus projects a map of the vagina. It might just as easily be the valley of the river Euphrates. Women are not like men, Fergus says. Women are like irons. They take a while to warm up. And men are not like women, Dervla answers. Men are like light bulbs. They switch on and off. Women like to talk a lot, Fergus says. Men like to be praised, Dervla counters. Next time he's digging in the garden, wave to him from the kitchen window. Run, Tom, run, Mary, run, Billy, run, Spot. Run, run, run. Now, the poem, which is the best I can do about loss, it's just called She Elopes with Marc Chagall. You know the figures in Chagall of people flying over the town. Across fields of rotting cabbages that nobody wanted to buy, the girl I loved went flying to the other end of the sky. Up she flew over the enormous satchels of the homebound primary scholars, over the disused dance halls and empty factories, over the wandering dogs in the itinerant encampments, over the 5 upturned wheelbarrows outside Grogan's hardware store on Main Street Swords, over the fleet of escort vans selling fruit, fuel and vegetables on the Dublin-Belfast road. When I went to the doctor, he said, in a week or two it'll be Easter. The sun will shine after tea. You'll be yourself again, sure of who you are, clear as a bell, with all the time in the world to find someone else. In the meantime, should that scalding sensation in the pit of your stomach persist, Try writing some verse. Tra-la-la, la-la. When it's springtime in Ireland, the fog comes in from the sea. The birds revive in the mornings. The earth smells sweet under me. At night, the rockabill foghorn summons her back from the dead. I remember her cheeks in blossom, the way that she turned her head. Easter came and went. Despite the quack's advice, I'm no better now than when I began. I torment myself by chanting their names. Maggie, Maggie, Mark Chagall. I used to, for 2.5 years, take the train in from Twickenham, the overground, but you get very fed up of people shouting out loud about K's and how many K's they earn and those kind of people. I was there one morning and I was the only one on the platform. It was between trains when this man came along, man of about 55, and he coughed, and I knew immediately by his cough, as anyone would, this guy thinks he's really important. And we were the only people on the platform. And, you know, it gets to you sometimes, this kind of thing, you know. There's a girl in a wine bar. She's been proposed to by an upwardly mobile person. And she has pictures in her past. She's not completely making for the loot. Of course, she's in the wrong place. It's called The Proposal. He'd put all his cards on the table. He had one foot on the ladder of the property market. Nigel, who he thought I fancied, might have a lovely personality, but he just couldn't sell. His own garden was west-facing. I wanted to tell him how midges bite before rain, and clouds turn dirt grey in November when it's about to snow. On the soft steps of the undertaker as he circled my father's coffin. That special sauntery way youth has of walking with all the time in the world. But he wasn't having it. From a distance of 250 miles, the other end of the A1, his mother butted in. You know Sylvia Norman, number 22, very sarcastic, plays bowls 5-6 times a week out of 7. She has a lunchtime drink too. Well on the way when she goes home, always pick, 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 pick. No, I'm sorry, but she's drinking heavily. Did you ever realize, Jules, I said, that 99% of the universe is dark matter whose composition is unknown? He wouldn't find the answer to that in the Estates Times or on the FTSE Index. When the corners of our mouths turn downwards, as they eventually do, is it the onset of age or the official unveiling of disappointment? It's just about somebody saying something out of context. We don't enjoy ourselves too much in Ireland. We get great pleasure out of not enjoying ourselves. It's just you go to the seaside and you see on a sunny day all the men lying under the cars, hiding from the sun, you know, by the family. Somebody, I think, said that the last circle of hell was composed of families in a Morris Minor out on a Sunday drive. Anyway, in the Catholic Rosary, there's a glorious mystery. And that's usually where, you know, people say the word glorious. So this is just picnic. She remembers the day at Ross's Point, the men lying on the grass, their heads under the engines of cars, hiding from the sun. They were the family by the seaside, finding their own sand dune, facing the red corrugated roof of the Neptune Beachery Stores, following the impossible freedom of the polo-necked middle-aged golfers in games stretching to Ben Bulben, drinking hot sugar tea with hardly a puff of wind as her mother shouted, "Isn't it a glorious day?" to a passing perfect stranger. With her shock at the sound of the word glorious, always a mystery before, and the broken sadness of their enforced joy, they didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Very confusing sometimes. This poem is about, it's in the voice of a young girl, a kind girl who becomes emotionally entangled in what's left of the life of a disturbed and homeless man, and finds herself gradually being drawn into his neurosis, becoming a figure in it. It's called "Every Part of It in Rains." Though it never was my name, he used to call me Eileen. He'd come into reception and deal with me alone. The others thought it a joke. "It's your special colour girl, the Paddy Dosser." But I was well pleased. That first claim I processed was an emergency payment gyro for a homeless man. The cow of a supervisor demanded, "Is he kipping in our area? If he's not kipping in our area, then tell him to bugger off." He told me he was sleeping near hand to Blackfriars Bridge, which every functionary knew came under the caring wing of Southwark ILO, not Battersea office at all. It was cold November outside. They were sweeping up the leaves. They were knocking down the street. So every second Monday, you couldn't stop him talking. "Boy, but time brings changes. Things are looking up in the old country. There's a half-page photo in this week's Irish Post. One of the younger Haughies is digging for gold. Then again, do you think it's the last throw of the dice? No, I'll stop where I am. There are places worse than the river." I looked into his face. It was free of the town of Athy. It was free of Gay Byrne. It was free of Pat Kenny. It was free of Trevor Danker. It was free of all the Smurfits. They never entered his head. When anxiety came to him, it flew into his stomach. The flits around his innards were little birds that put on weight and held him down until he could not move. He'd sit all day in the waiting room writing me notes I'll never forget. "Eileen, I would like Ireland for good, my country, life in danger here from a policeman of England, Mr. John Brain. I left his service. Eileen, I know Ireland very well, like my person, went over it, know every part of it in rains. Eileen, please excuse paper, no money, no envelopes, better being a real tramp, I will end wrong in this world. Eileen, I lived alone in Corporation House owned by Public Works Department, Shaftpool Lane, my life of hell. Metropolitan Police Officer, no good, Mr. Brain, my life is hell on earth. Eileen, I lost my father last year, 81 years old, a big loss to my person. Eileen, I'm Irish in England since 1960, many works, hospitals. I am not educated, 52 years old. I want some kind happiness. Please marry me. Eileen, I had my house, was wrecked, even bulbs, wires in cooker ruined, hit in my eyes, beatings purple. Eileen." The last time I saw him standing on the new pavement outside the Golden Halibut takeaway, he struggled to greet me and shook my hand. "How are you, Mrs. Brain? And how is John? And all the little ones? Please send them my regards." If I had a heart, he'd surely break it. I ran through the market of Strutton Ground, was stopped by a barrow, purchased two pairs of cotton shorts for £5.99 in a tropical shade. I'll never wear them. I don't know if you notice often at lunchtimes particularly, people going out of offices and coming back with large cards. Somebody else is going, leaving, going elsewhere. And you know, there's a whip round and the person leaving, or if it's their birthday, they buy cakes or chocolates. And out of that life, a life spent kind of battling with time, well, it's most people's lives, it's the working life, flexible time. Fastest of all fly the leavings, when every other week we gather by the bottled water machine, while a large card is presented, plus a whip round from the staff, a lump sum in a grid envelope. The departee's desk is ringed with smaller cards, as it was on all his birthdays. X to 40 years among the greens, greys and browns of office furniture, the standard issue fans, clocks, coat stands, air heaters, chairs, calculators, the cold fluorescent bulbs and cream Venetian blinds go walkies in a 5-minute ceremony. But the office survives us and continues in complicity with those deceptions we half live by, that the organisation gives something back, that by sullen striving we will be better thought of, that all movement is upward. Only in dreamland does the truth surface. There, someone steals our coffee mug, the quiet corner in the restroom where they pin the holiday postcards is hastily cordoned off. The supervisor's door turns to glass as he sits facing the section. In a small place where most people know each other, or where what you say will eventually be picked up by somebody else, a trick around things is that people will say the most ferocious things about people, cutting them to the quick, and at the end they say, ah, he's all right, you know. So they give all the dirt, but they cannot be blamed. So this is, it's an attempt to get that kind of movement which happens in conversation in small places everywhere all the time. In big places, they're not bothered. They're trying to keep themselves together to have some kind of existence against the world. This is called One of Our Own. See that fellow over there? He's a main get. Cut him dead. He embezzled a lot of money. His wife isn't well in the head. He molested children too in his day. He was assistant county engineer, took early retirement, was pushed out of the way. Before he left, he refused planning permission to half the bucking country. He was severe enough with his own. Signs on, they fled the nest. Not one about the place, but who can throw the first stone? He's not a bad fella, really. His bark is worse than his bite. Behind it all, he's a nice poor devil. I wouldn't have anything said, no, not against Redmond McEntee. Deep down, he's all right, the last word, a gentleman from head to toe who never did any harm to me. It's just a little exile's poem to end with. Gimme, as in Fergie, gimme, gimme, gimme. Or the stereotype of Fergie. Gimme. Cold winter nights by the Irish Sea, when the passing lights of the 33 bus bounce off greenhouse roofs on the road to Loch Shinney and cars pass lengthways down Main Street and Church Street. Not this cul-de-sac in Lower East Acton, where curtains stay open when front rooms are lit up and rows of terraced houses are watching Ski Sunday as newspaper tents collapse behind sofas in the last 3 hours of an English weekend. Thank you.